Carl Crittens. I'm the director of the China and the World program here at Columbia University. Thanks for joining us this evening. We have a special guest. Last week, we had one of our fellows, Sabina Mokries, speak on her work. Today, we have another fellow, John David Minnick, who's going to speak about his research. And next week, we'll have Lucy Liu. So we'll have three in a row of our fellows. It's always a special pleasure to invite our postdoctoral fellows to speak. We have tremendous respect for them. They came through a very competitive process. And John David Minnick, John came to us from MIT, where he got his PhD under the tutelage of Taylor Frabel. And Taylor was one of the first fellows in the China in the World program. So John came to us almost as a China in the World family from the beginning. And Taylor, as you know, is a very distinguished scholar of China's foreign relations and security policy. John focuses on technology transfer policy in a rising China. His dissertation addressed those issues. And we're proud to announce and happy to announce that in fall of 2024, John will start his new job as an assistant professor of international political economy at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Prior to studying at MIT, John worked in political risk analysis and lived and studied in China for 2 years. Really thrilled to have him speak today and look forward to learning from him. Over to you, John.
Cool. Thank you, Tom. And thanks everybody for coming out. I know this is not the most opportune time of the year. It's a very busy time for everybody. So today I'm going to be talking about a paper that is based on part of my dissertation and I guess now first book project. So the larger project looks at the evolution of technology transfer policy in China in the post-Cold War period. And this particular paper focuses on China's use of a sort of subset of those policies, which are formal overt technology transfer mandates and associated policies, in particular in the first 10 to 15 years after China joined the WTO in 2001. So I guess before I get started, I want to just offer a couple of reasons why people in the room should care about technology transfer policy in China. And the first reason is that, unfortunately, China's use of technology transfer policies has been really central to the rapid deterioration in U.S.-China relations in recent years and the acceleration of Sino-American technological competition. And here I'll just highlight that President Trump's rhetoric notwithstanding, if you actually look at the documents that outline the U.S. government's rationale for imposing trade sanctions on China and launching the trade war in 2018, what's striking is that they are almost exclusively focused on problems of so-called forced technology transfer and intellectual property theft, not on the trade balance or things like standard non-tariff tariff barriers and tariffs. So the second reason is that, relatedly, technology transfer policies, while by no means perfectly effective, have been really important to China's economic and technological rise in recent decades. And in particular, I think go a long way towards explaining the genuinely remarkable progress, or say genuinely remarkable speed with which China caught up to the world frontier in a wide variety of high technology and high value added industries. And finally, these policies are simply not very well studied or very well understood within the political science and international relations literatures. And I think that's a problem because, as this figure suggests, in the 15 years after China joined the WTO, its use of formal policies associated with technology transfer increased quite dramatically, peaking, by my count, around 2014, 2015, at on the order of 350 distinct policies covering roughly one quarter of all industries in China. And I would add that this increase was not only quantitative, but also qualitative in terms of the intensity and the effectiveness of the enforcement of a lot of the policies on the books. However, within that broad-based and quite dramatic increase in the use of these policy tools, there is, I think, genuinely puzzling variation across industries in China's propensity to actually impose these measures. So, for example, China uses technology transfer policies aggressively in most of the usual suspect industries, high value added, high technology sectors like aircraft design and manufacturing, automotive production, renewable energy technology, high speed rail, and the list goes on. At the same time, China uses these tools sparingly and in some cases never once uses them in a number of equally economically vital high technology industries, things like battery and accumulator technology, various kinds of precision measurement and navigational equipment, and for me at least, most surprisingly, semiconductor design and fabrication, arguably the strategic high technology industry par excellence. So my question is, what explains this variation in China's use of technology transfer policies? To begin, what accounts for that increase we saw, both quantitative and qualitative, in the intensity of the enforcement of these policies over time? And second, and I think more importantly, why does China use them so energetically in some high technology industries, but not in others? So my argument in a nutshell is that top-down national power and regime security considerations lead China to pursue technology transfers in something like objectively strategic industries, industries that most major and great powers, not just China, would regard as such. However, China is constrained in using these tools, even in the most strategically vital high technology sectors, by its bargaining power vis-a-vis the foreign firms that invest there. And China's bargaining power rests, I think, on two fundamental pillars. The first is what I call central state enforcement capacity. And I use this to denote the state's ability to effectively coordinate and implement national policy priorities on a nationwide basis. And the second is where China sits in global value chains in a given industry. In particular, whether China is downstream of global production processes as a final market, or on the other hand, China occupies an intermediate position in global production networks as an offshore export processing hub for servicing customers in other countries. So the project makes three main contributions to the literature. The first is to define and operationalize my core concept, which I call technology extraction policies. And I use this term to describe the subset of the broader universe of technology transfer related practices that focus on the state's ability to regulate inflows of foreign direct investment and goods to extract technology from foreign firms. And I argue three policies broadly exhaust this concept in post-WTO China. The first and probably substantively most important are joint venture requirements and other formal ownership restrictions on inward FDI into China. For example, these would be things that require foreign firms as a condition of market access to form an equity or a cooperative joint venture with a Chinese company. I also look at local content requirements, which China uses, I think, somewhat idiosyncratically, not to deter foreign firms from entering the Chinese market, but actually in many cases to incentivize them or compel them to expand operations in China, to partner with and train local suppliers from which they subsequently source inputs, and in the process transfer both physical technology and various forms of tacit know-how to those Chinese suppliers. And finally, I look at preferential government procurement policies, which again, China uses in a somewhat idiosyncratic fashion, not to exclude foreign firms from government procurement markets in China, but to incentivize them as a condition for preferential treatment in those markets to do things like open research and development centers in China or to co-develop products with Chinese companies so that their products can qualify as having been made with a certain amount of Chinese intellectual property. So the second contribution is to construct an original measure of China's use of these policy tools from 1995 to 2015. And I do this by collecting and manually analyzing well over 500 pages of Chinese language, Chinese central state laws and regulations on these three policy tools. And then finally, I present evidence that strategic industries account for the vast majority of the increase in China's use of these policy tools over the course of the post-WTO period, but that China is much less likely to use them in strategic industries in which it occupies an intermediate position in global value chains than in strategic industries in which it is downstream of production processes as a final market. All right, so the first part of the theory makes the case that top-down national power and regime security considerations provide the central motive behind China's pursuit of technology transfers. And that motive, simply put, is to transform China into a major or dominant global power by, in Xi Jinping's words, seizing the commanding heights of technological competition in the 21st century. And in making this argument, I am drawing on realist approaches to political economy, which emphasize the intelligibility and the analytical value of the concept of a national interest in shaping not only foreign security policy, but also in some conditions, foreign economic policy. And I think realism is a particularly appropriate lens for thinking about technology transfer and industrial policy more generally in China, given China's status as simultaneously a rising great power in an increasingly competitive strategic environment, as a late modernizer that has actively self-consciously modeled its development strategy on those of post-war East Asian developmental states, and finally as an authoritarian regime that has long staked its political legitimacy in part on economic performance. And the basic point here is that for each of these classes of state, there is a literature which attests to the fact that economic policy under some conditions shapes not only security policy, or that top-down security interests shape not only security policy, but sometimes quite granular economic policies. And I would just add to this that China's Leninist political structure gives it its leaders a, you know, by no means perfect, but nonetheless sometimes quite effective policy mechanism for translating these top-down interests directly into granular economic and industrial policies. So the takeaway from this is that China will pursue, or that these top-down national power and security concerns lead China to pursue tech extraction in industries that China's leaders expect to provide the best return on their investment in terms of long-run national economic power and competitiveness. And these are what I'm calling strategically important industries. So the second part of the theory then looks at the relationship between variation over time in the enforcement capacity of the central state on the one hand, and that first pattern I showed, which was the rise in the post-WTO period and China's use of technology extraction policies. And in the paper, I trace a sort of broadly three-step process in the growth of central state enforcement capacity that begins with a series of administrative reforms and restructuring in the late 1990s and early 2000s, which have the cumulative effect of quite substantially reducing bureaucratic fragmentation, both at the top and the bottom of China's central economic policy apparatus. And the main way that they do this is by eliminating the vast majority of industry-specific ministries, like the Ministry of Power and Energy and things like that, as well as consolidate power at the top of the economic policy apparatus in the hands of a single macroeconomic policy body. And that body is the National Development and Reform Commission. So the second big step in this process is the rise and sort of consolidation of the authority of the NDRC over the course of the early 2000s, really cementing its status as both sort of the dominant economic policy body within China, but also, more importantly for my story, as the key gatekeeper for foreign firms trying to enter the Chinese market. And this really comes to a head in 2004 and 2005, when the NDRC, through a series of reforms, gains effectively unilateral power of approval for all large-scale inward foreign direct investment into China. So basically, the NDRC is the one calling the shots on most of these formal policies that I'm talking about. And then finally, I think that this process in the growth of enforcement capacity sort of culminates, at least in approximate sense, in the year 2006, when China launches a policy called the Medium and Long-Term Program for National Science and Technology Development. And where I think that where technology transfer is concerned, I think the primary impact of the MLP, as it's known, is to really provide the NDRC carte blanche to dramatically expand technology transfer efforts that were already well underway in its core policy domains to a much wider array of strategic industries. Okay, so we have a sense now of the motives behind technology transfer and what explains the rise over time in the use of these policies, but we still have this problem to explain the quite significant observed variation in China's propensity to use these tools across similarly strategic high technology industries. So just to illustrate this, look at over here, this column right here shows that in the 15 years after China joined the WTO, it used 29 distinct foreign direct investment ownership restrictions in various parts of the aircraft manufacturing supply chain, while at the same time, it used zero in semiconductor design and fabrication over the course of the same period. So I argue that this industry-level variation in China's use of tech extraction policies across strategic industries depends first and foremost on where China sits in global value chains in these industries. So let's look at the case of industries where China is downstream of production processes. So here, what I really mean are industries where most of what is imported into China is ultimately consumed there in the end. So these are industries where, or I guess in these industries, we're in a sort of classic market power world. These are industries where foreign firms depend very heavily on China as a final market for their goods. And that gives China extraordinary leverage to impose various kinds of market access concessions, including in many cases, compliance with outright technology transfer mandates. And just to illustrate this, I'll offer an anecdote from the high-speed rail industry. So a couple years ago, I had an interview with a longtime employee of the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, who recounted how in the early 2000s, when the Chinese government announced plans to build out the national high-speed rail network, according to the story, at least, the Chinese government invited senior executives from the big four high-speed rail companies at the time. So this is Siemens, Bombardier, Alstom, and Kawasaki. And again, according to the story, Chinese officials brought these executives to Beijing, put them in
hotel rooms on the same floor in the same hotel in Beijing. And over the course of 3 or 4 days, officials from the NDRC and the Ministry of Railways circulated between these rooms until they had extracted agreements from each CEO independently of effectively maximum technology transfer at a minimum price. And the point is that China could get away with this in an industry like high-speed rail because these companies rightly anticipated that China's high-speed rail network would be one of the largest infrastructure development projects in human history, and therefore a market that was of existential importance to them. They could not risk losing out on a chunk of this market, even if they knew they were going to be phased out eventually. They had to get a foothold in this market, lest they risk losing that foothold to one of their competitors. But I think we're in a very different world when we look at industries where China is intermediate to global production networks. So these are industries where most of what China imports isn't actually consumed there in the end. Rather, it is processed locally, assembled into more finished goods, things like iPads and iPhones, and then re-exported back out to consumer markets in the US, Europe, and elsewhere. So in these industries, I think two things happen that shift what I call the balance of dependence between China and foreign investors. First, foreign firms rely much less on China as a final market for their goods. And this follows from the fact that most of what foreign firms are doing in China in these industries isn't targeting the Chinese market. It's using China as a temporary base for processing and assembling goods that they send to customers in other countries. Now, the flip side of that is that in these industries, China depends heavily on those same foreign firms and the value chains that they control to guarantee its access to overseas consumer markets, and in turn to drive export growth and associated employment inside China. And my argument is that this combination of reduced foreign firm reliance on China and increased Chinese reliance on foreign firms to drive export growth and employment shifts the balance of dependence, giving foreign firms new resources that they can use to more credibly threaten a costly exit from the Chinese market and more effectively push back on technology transfer requirements by the Chinese government. And just to illustrate what's at stake for China and industries where it sits in the middle of global value chains, consider that in the post-WTO period, exports as a share of China's GDP reached 40%, nearly 40%, making China one of the most export-dependent major economies in the world. And during this period, the share of exports tied to export processing trade, so industries where China is intermediate to these production networks, consistently exceeded 50%. And also during this period, foreign firms and their affiliates in China accounted for well over 80% of all export processing trade. So simply put, we're talking about a period of time where foreign firm-dominated global value chains accounted for somewhere on the order of 14 to 16% of Chinese GDP and supplied upwards of tens of millions of jobs in politically sensitive and economically dynamic cities like Shanghai and Shenzhen. All right, so these arguments yield three testable hypotheses. The first is that all else equal, China will use technology extraction policies more often in strategic industries than in non-strategic industries. Second, its use of these tools in strategic industries should increase over time following gains in enforcement capacity. And finally, China should be less likely to use tech extraction policies in the subset of strategic industries where it is intermediate to global value chains than in strategic industries in which it is downstream of value chains as a final market. And this just illustrates the basic flow of the argument. And the key point to highlight here is that these boxes on the outside are necessary but individually insufficient conditions for the use of tech extraction policies. So only when we have a strategic industry, when enforcement capacity is high, and when China's downstream of production networks in that industry, will we see something like really aggressive or assertive use of technology extraction policies. In all other sectors, China's going to be pretty constrained in using these tools.
They do.
And I get into this elsewhere. They do. There are cases where they're trying to bargain, they're trying to use these tools. And then, of course, as a substitute for this, they will sometimes use informal pressures as a kind of second best option. But yes, yeah, so no, there's definitely evidence where they have wanted to use various kinds of formal technology transfer policies, but just don't have the bargaining power for it. And I'll get to that a little bit in one of the case studies. Okay, so I test these hypotheses using a combination of quantitative analysis of my original data set on tech extractors, as well as qualitative case studies on technology extraction efforts in two strategic high technology industries, wind turbine technology and semiconductor design and fabrication. So for the quantitative portion of the empirical analysis, the outcome of interest is the number of these policies in place in a given industry and year from 1995 to 2015. The explanatory variable is the interaction effect between, on the one hand, whether or not an industry is strategic and on the other hand, China's bargaining power in that industry. And I look at this relationship after controlling for different measures of bottom-up interest group pressures, which I think of as sort of the most plausible or certainly like the mainstream alternative explanation for the motivation behind the use of these policies, as well as controlling for year and industry fixed effects. For the main model specification, I use plus on regression with cluster robust standard errors clustered by industry and year. But for robustness, I rerun the analysis using a variety of modeling strategies, controlling for lag-dependent variables, and using alternative measures of both the independent and dependent variables of interest. So I then use case studies of wind turbine technology and semiconductor production to try to tease out the mechanisms behind the argument. So I think political scientists and IR scholars generally should care about when China and countries generally use technology transfer policies, because at the end of the day, these are policies that foreign multinational enterprises, especially MNEs in technology-intensive industries, really care about when they are making foreign investments. The problem is that off-the-shelf data sets on things like FDI regulatory restrictions or non-tariff barriers either completely omit these policy tools or don't measure them at anywhere near a sufficient level of granularity. So the first empirical task and contribution of the project is to try to create a systematic map of China's use of these policy tools in the post-Cold War period, which, as I said, I do by analyzing several hundred pages of Chinese language, central state laws and regulations on the three policies that make up my concept of tech extraction policy. And in the interest of time, I'll go through this, I think, quickly now, but I'm happy to talk about how I measure each of these policy tools of interest in detail in the Q&A section. But I do want to just give you a sense of the basic coding procedure for the data set. So what we see on the, what is that for you guys? That's the left-hand side, is the first page of the 2015 edition of the Foreign Direct Investment Industry Guidance Catalog. So this is the authoritative regulation issued by the National Development and Reform Commission that specifies industries in which foreign investment is encouraged, restricted, and prohibited, but it also includes industry-specific requirements regarding whether firms should form equity joint ventures or other forms of partnerships with Chinese companies. So it's very small in this projector, but basically what this is here is a requirement that inward FDI in oil and natural gas take the form of an equity or cooperative joint venture. So the middle panel here is the corresponding industry name and industry code in the Chinese Standard Industrial Classification Scheme, which is the Chinese government's official industry classification scheme, as the name suggests. And the good thing is that China uses more or less the exact same terminology to describe industries in the FDI catalogs and similar policies as it uses in its industry classification scheme. So the final step is then to correspond the industry codes in the Chinese scheme with the International Standard Industrial Classification System, which allows me to merge this data with econometric data and industry data from outside of China. And fortunately for me, the Chinese government has gone through the very painful process of pre-harmonizing their own classification scheme with the international classification scheme. So I'm able to just directly harmonize from that with a few minor modifications. Okay, so as I said, the explanatory variable is the interaction between the strategic status of an industry and China's bargaining power in that industry. Now, I'm interested in the impact of something like objective strategic interests in China's behavior. So for my main measure, I want a measure of strategic industry that is going to be exogenous to Chinese government policy documents themselves, because at the end of the day, I don't know the data generating process behind some of those government policy documents. I do use a measure based on the government policy documents themselves as an alternative measure just for robustness. But for the main measure, I want to get some measure that captures this idea of if the Chinese government were really seriously thinking about what is actually strategic rather than what some particular SOE tells it is strategic, what kinds of industries would it look to pursue technology transfers in? And so to do this, I adapted typology from a recent paper by Jeffrey Ding and Alan Defoe, where they outline three logics by which an industry or an asset might be regarded as strategic. The first of these is basically industries with high barriers to entry due to things like R&D intensity, cumulative learning effects, or economies of scale in production. The second is basic infrastructure industries, road, rail, port infrastructure. And the third is various critical industrial inputs, strategic minerals, things like that. So building on the discussion from earlier, I then used the launch of the medium and long-term program in 2006 as a sort of rough proxy for the beginning of a period of increased enforcement capacity. So basically, after the launch of the medium and long-term program, we should see more intensive use of these policies. And then to measure China's position in global value chains, I use a measure of the share of imports tied to export processing trade in a given industry year. The idea being that the higher the share of imports that are tied to processing trade, the more intermediate China is to global value chains. The lower that share, the more of what China's importing is actually staying in China. So China's a market in those industries as opposed to a temporary processing base to service customers elsewhere. And then finally, I control for two variables that are really different ways of getting at the alternative explanation that bottom-up interest group pressures as opposed to top-down strategic interests are the driving factor behind China's pursuit of technology transfers. Okay, so here we see the total number of these policies in place by year from 1995 to 2015. And I'll just highlight 3 points. So first, we see that after 2006, the year the MLP is launched, there is a really dramatic increase in the use of these policy tools. However, that increase is almost entirely concentrated in strategic industries. China is very much less likely to use these policy tools in industries which, by my measure, which I try to construct this exogenous measure of strategic, which by that measure are not strategic. And then finally, though, we see that the increase of these tools is concentrated in the subset of strategic industries in which China is downstream of global value chains. Notably, China appears to be really no more likely to use these policy tools in strategic industries where it's intermediate to production networks, so that would be things like semiconductor design and fabrication, than it is in non-strategic industries. All right, so here we see the marginal effect of going from not strategic to strategic on the use of these tools across different levels of processing trade dependence. That's what's on the x-axis. So basically what this is showing is that at low levels of processing trade, I think my pointer just died. Oh, it's there. It's just very light. Okay. So basically, as we go towards zero on the x-axis, so at low levels of processing trade dependence, these are industries where China is downstream of value chains. Being strategic really matters for the use of technology transfer policies. Going from not strategic to strategic has a big positive impact, or is positively correlated with the use of technology transfer policies. However, as we go down the x-axis, so these are going from downstream to more and more intermediate industries, we see that this relationship becomes substantially weaker. So this suggests that whether or not an industry is strategic does influence Chinese policy behavior, but the extent to which it influences that behavior is very much conditional on where China sits in global production processes. And the relationship is not only statistically significant, but substantively large. So at low levels of processing trade dependence in strategic industries, China uses somewhere between 3 and 4 of these policies in a given year. As China becomes more intermediate to global value chains, the number falls to somewhere between 0 and 1. And again, notably, we see really no comparable relationship between GVC position and the use of these policy tools in non-strategic industries. So this is really, whatever is happening here, it's a function of these strategically important sectors. Okay, so then to probe the mechanisms behind the sort of two main parts of the theory about the use of these tools within strategic industries, I conduct case studies of technology extraction efforts in two strategic high-tech sectors. So the wind power case study is really focused on teasing out the relationship between enforcement capacity, improvements in the state's enforcement capacity, and the more assertive use of technology transfer policies over time. And the basic story with wind power is that this is a sector where, beginning in at least the early 1990s, Chinese central authorities had very clearly signaled their interest in developing Chinese capabilities in the sector. They had also very clearly signaled that they understood that doing so would require technology transfers on a very large scale. And they tried to get those technology transfers from foreign firms, and they by and large failed. And a lot of things contribute to that failure, but I think one really crucial element here is that this is a period of pretty substantial bureaucratic fragmentation at various levels of the economic policy apparatus, and including at the very top, where you had basically the State Economic and Trade Commission, which was sort of the main macroeconomic policy body at the time, competing with the State Planning Commission, which is the sort of Mao era holdover planning body, basically both of them issuing virtually, I mean, like if you look at the language of the policy documents, they're virtually identical documents. They're issuing different documents within months of each other with competing mandates. And I think, you know, basically we end up in a situation where foreign firms are doing venue shopping, or for various reasons, there's just a lot of policy incohesion. And the Chinese state has a very hard time actually getting foreign firms to engage in large-scale technology transfers. And we see at this time the use of language around sort of encouraging technology transfer, but very little show up in policy documents around sort of hard sector-wide mandates. And I think that the ineffectiveness of China's policy efforts during this period are clearly reflected in the trajectory of installed wind power capacity in China. So throughout the 1990s, it's extremely limited. So the situation changes pretty dramatically with the creation and consolidation of the National Development and Reform Commission in 2003. So within a year of its formation, the NDRC embarks on an ambitious campaign of technology localization of wind power, first through a series of local content requirements through a program called the Wind Power Concession Program, and then in 2005, expanding these local content requirements nationwide. So basically what the NDRC does is it says, if you want to build a wind farm in China, you need to source 70% of your content locally. Of course, the trick was that at that time, there weren't enough Chinese firms from which foreign firms could actually source 70% of the wind turbine content from. So the reality was that what ended up happening is that all of the big wind turbine multinationals like Vestas from Denmark or Siemens Gamesa basically took this as a cue to dramatically ramp up their operations in China, working with all of these local suppliers, sending sometimes hundreds of engineers to different companies in China to train them so that these foreign companies could subsequently source inputs from them, and in the process transfer various kinds of both sort of tacit know-how, but also lots of real physical capital technology. So I think this quote from the New York Times nicely captures that. Basically, what they say is that the Chinese government correctly bet that rather than fight local content requirements, leading multinational wind turbine makers would opt to open factories in China and train local suppliers to meet the 70% threshold. And just going back to the previous slide, what's pretty remarkable about this massive ascent installed wind power capacity in China is that by about 2009, 2010, so the policy is implemented in 2005, by about 2009, 2010, upwards of 90% of that is actually made by Chinese companies. So there is this really rapid injection of technology and know-how into the Chinese industry that forms a sort of primitive accumulation period for the development of the rest of the sector. Okay, so I then look at semiconductors to tease out the relationship between value chain position and the non-use or the sparing use of these policy tools in otherwise strategic high technology sectors. And so what this figure here shows, it's a little small here, but what the figure shows is the top line is the share of imports tied to export processing trade over time in semiconductors. The bottom line is the corresponding share for wind turbine technology. So what we see here is that throughout the study period, exports or imports tied to processing trade accounted for between 75 and 90% of all semiconductor related imports in China. Over the same period, imports tied to export processing trade accounted for between 3 and 23% of all wind power related imports. So China is comfortably downstream of value chains in wind power and uncomfortably smack dab in the middle of value chains in semiconductor design and fabrication. In my interviews with various industry insiders, current and former government officials, employees and executives from American technology companies that had invested in China, I think provide compelling evidence that this intermediacy to value chains and the dependencies that created on China's behalf on foreign firms was the decisive factor that undercut China's leverage, preventing it from introducing technology transfer policies in semiconductors. So this first quote comes from an interview I did in 2021 with a senior executive of the Semiconductor Industry Association, which is the main industry association representing, both American and foreign semiconductor companies, but based in Washington, D.C. And this person told me other industries, rail, wind, and aircraft, are closed loop, meaning that most of what enters China stays in China. which gives China incredible leverage over foreign investors. By contrast, in semiconductors, for much of the 2000s, the vast majority of consumption by companies in China was for manufacture and export to international customers. So what this quote establishes is that other industries were closed loop. This gave them leverage. Semiconductors was, as this person called it, open loop, which undercut China's leverage vis-a-vis these foreign firms. So here's another quote from a conversation I had last year with a leading China-based industry expert, semiconductor industry expert. And this person corroborated the previous interview, basically said, at the time, much of the market in semiconductors was for re-export processing. So not strong leverage to impose JV. So China lacked leverage to impose explicit JV requirements on foreign companies. Instead, China had to offer sweetheart deals to lure investment. So basically, these quotes illustrate, one, China was intermediate to production networks and semiconductors, whereas in these other industries in which it used these tools very aggressively, it was downstream of those networks. Two, that differential positioning in production networks shaped China's bargaining power vis-a-vis foreign firms. And three, the intermediacy, China's intermediacy in semiconductors undercut its leverage to impose joint venture requirements on foreign shipmakers. All right, so I'll just wrap up now by offering a few takeaways from the project. So the first is basically that existing accounts of economic policymaking, including in authoritarian contexts, which are still very much understudied in the mainstream IP literature, but including an authoritarian context, really begins from the assumption that bottom-up interest group pressures are the key determinant of economic policy outcomes. And that basically states are reduced to sort of relatively minimal roles as at most sort of arbiters between these different competing interest groups, or maybe states have sort of a weak independent commitment to balancing the need for political support from interest groups with a desire to maximize general welfare. But basically, there's very little role in mainstream literature on economic policy for the idea of states as reasonably coherent, relatively independent actors acting in economic policy on behalf of interests that are not reducible to societal interest groups. So one thing I hope to do with this project is to show, or is by showing that the strategic interests seem to influence an important form of trade-related policy in the world's largest trading nation, to basically suggest a need to bring the state back in a much more central way to the study of trade and industrial policy. So the second contribution, I think, is to show that market power, which tends to be equated, you know, when we think about states exercising market power and therefore coercive leverage over firms and potentially over other states, typically this is equated in, I think, a fairly simplistic way with the size of a country's internal market. What I'm trying to do here is to show that market size alone isn't really enough to explain when states wield market power over firms and other states, that we have to look at in the first instance, this is point two, we have to look at the state's institutions, because institutions, and in this case, the sort of centralization of regulatory authority and the gain of enforcement capacity play a really important role in mediating states' ability to leverage their market size as an actual source of coercive leverage over foreign firms and foreign governments. So the third point is, in a similar vein, that I think to understand more granular dynamics of bargaining over things like technology transfer, we need to look at how countries are differentially positioned in global value chains in different industries, and how that in turn shapes dynamics of bargaining over technology transfer and market access between states and sometimes very powerful foreign investors. And the basic point here being that you know, I think what my findings suggest is that intermediacy to GVCs, or you could say from the firm's perspective, embedding a state like China or a country like China in an intermediate position in global production networks can actually give firms really durable and powerful ex post leverage over those states that plays an important role in constraining them from imposing otherwise quite coercive policies. And that leads to the final point, which I offer somewhat, tentatively here, but basically just to say, you know, at least if my arguments are correct, then I think foreign governments like the U.S. now, foreign to China, that is, should think really carefully as they encourage their companies to shift production away from China? Because my findings suggest it was in precisely those industries where China is most deeply integrated into global production networks that it was most constrained in using these policy tools. And if China is no longer embedded in those networks, but if foreign firms like Apple still depend on China as a market for their goods, then actually by shifting production away from China, foreign firms could be in a worse bargaining position vis-a-vis the Chinese state when it comes to things like technology transfer practice. And I think that this is a point that particularly holds for China, but also I would submit, you know, applies potentially more generally to countries like India looking forward, and so forth. And with that, I'll wrap up. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, John. I really appreciate it. I can see now why you asked me to be a vote politics, but the last point.
Pacifying effects of global value chains. Not that many people agree with that. I hope you get it out quick. So I have a few questions, but I'll offer a couple and then turn to the audience. And one of the things that I just a comment, one of the things I was impressed with in your graphs is I remember in 2006, it was Hu Jintao. He launched the Indigenous Innovation Drive in 2006. And we, you know, we took notice of this. And this was really the kind of precursor to Made in China 2025. And we saw it as potentially significant and potentially negative when I was in the government. But it didn't seem to really take hold from what I saw until after the financial crisis. And then it seemed like the Chinese government really dedicated itself more to creating more domestic production and moving away from integration with the global economy. But your graph suggests that 2006 was a big year. It seems like even when you know the intermediate production is lower than the China end user products, they both go up pretty sharply. Yeah. The slope is pretty sharp in 2006. So it looks like Hu Jintao had more juice than I thought. Yeah. He was pushing for that. It's just a comment. The two things that stuck out for me is strategic industries, because I do international security. I always think about military application. Yeah. And turbofan jet engine technology is obviously dual use, wind not so much. Mm. And my impression from wind, and it's a superficial impression, so you can correct it. Is that a lot of the Chinese advances in wind technology was just stolen. Mm-hmm. That it wasn't forced transfer. It was just, they went around the world and they studied other people's wind technologies and took it home with them. Mm-hmm. There's a guy in Massachusetts who had some major breakthrough in the turbines to make them more efficient, who says that his technology has been 100% copied by the leading Chinese firms. He's not entirely certain how they got it, but he's quite certain that this innovation was just taken from him. So that's a little bit different. So I think people are going to ask you that over time, like how much of this is market leverage leading to JV agreements that are favorable to the Chinese side because they forced transfer, and how much of this is just, you know, Chinese agents around the world taking the leading technology in an industry and bringing it home with them.
Cool. Great.
So that's my question. Yeah. The military application piece, how important is it? Is it not important? Mm-hmm. And then the stealing piece were my two questions.
Should I go ahead and respond to those?
Whatever you want to do. We can take more questions or you can do what you like.
I'll address those quickly. So yeah, I think on the 2006 point, and actually, you know, this is a point that Yelling Tan in her book also makes, that basically making the case for 2006 as a turning point. And actually, I think there's some sort of, there's a bit of wiggle room in the literature right now, because there's another piece by Barry Naughton and Chunling that basically makes the case that actually, I mean, if you think about it, so it was like 2006 with the launch of the medium and long-term program, which was the document that really announced indigenous innovation in a big way. But then actually the reality is the medium and long-term program, the drafting process for that was 2 years, you know? Right. So, I mean,
and then you had the financial crisis. There's
a lot of, I mean, it's a gradual process. I mean, it's definitely.
But your lines are sharp.
No, it's true. So I think 2006 was a really key year, at least where technology transfer is concerned. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of points on that though, that I was surprised when I found this, because for another thing I'm working on, I basically collected data on pretty much like tried to find all policy documents that contain the terms indigenous innovation and track mm-hmm. the use of this term over time. And one thing that I just think is striking is that actually indigenous innovation appears in something like 250 policy documents going back to the mid-1990s. So this is a concept that had been percolating through mm-hmm. that sort of policy ecosystem in China for mm-hmm. a decade before the medium long-term program. But then obviously takes off with that. I mean, that's just a comment on your mm-hmm. comment. But yeah, no, I think there's a fair amount of evidence that yeah, I mean, basically 2009, 2010 with the stimulus program just adds so much juice to all of this. Yeah. But the policy direction and like the real policy turning point comes earlier. So when you think about sort of the precise timing of this, I think, you know, we can't attribute it all to the financial crisis, right. Basically. It's right. kind of the key point. And actually what's interesting about the medium long-term program is that in the definition of indigenous innovation offered in the MLP, it has three kind of core components, and one of those components is technology transfer. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, there was this idea that technology transfer and the re-innovation of foreign technology will be the basis for promoting indigenous innovation. So just an aside on that. So on the strategic industries, yeah, I mean, this is something that I thought about, and I mean, you know, I definitely struggled a lot with like how to kind of conceptualize and operationalize this concept of strategic industries, and mm-hmm. I'm honestly not entirely sure how wedded I am, other than to say that, I mean, what I'm trying to get at is the state thinking in a relatively coherent way about what it needs to do to maintain or accelerate China's long-term, I think, economic power and competitiveness. So not just about military capabilities, although those are downstream of mm-hmm. the economic capabilities. But I think in the case of wind turbine technology, there's a case to be made. I mean, if we're thinking of strategic from the perspective of both national power and regime security considerations, that actually the Chinese government did see renewable energy technology, with wind actually being one of wind and hydro being the sort of two biggest ones to begin with, as like actually important for their longevity as a regime. So, mm-hmm. But I think it's a fair point I'm not focusing on sort of a narrow definition of strategic in terms of military capabilities here. But I welcome, you know, more pushback on that or suggestions. And then on the sort of like stolen, how much of this is just sort of outright theft versus sort of these kinds of technology transfer policies. You know, I mean, I think it kind of has to be taken as a sort of starting point that simultaneously to all of the formal stuff China was doing, various Chinese state actors were doing espionage. I mean, that's just been a kind of baseline practice for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's really hard to measure systematically, which is why I didn't end up focusing on that. But I do try to get at that in the kind of broader dissertation project, but just not very systematically. What I'll say on wind turbine technology is that there's a pretty good secondary literature on sort of the development of China's wind energy industry. And I would just say that I think there's a lot of evidence that it was cooperation between foreign firms and Chinese firms and their activities in China that did a lot of the work. Not everything, but did a lot of the work in terms of building up the, you know, because there's sort of like, okay, there's taking blueprints and then there's nurturing an ecosystem. And I think it's right. the ecosystem around the kind of manufacturing innovation, which China has really excelled at. That's what China allows China to scale these industries up
right
so quickly. And that's something that I think
creating the supply chain within China, that's obviously government policy. I think in this case in Massachusetts, it's just some gadget that makes the turbine spin more effectively. And
fully believe
it. When the full gadget is missing, it looks like theft.
Yeah, no, yeah, I believe that for sure.
I don't understand the physics. No. All right, I have other questions, but I'll open it up to others.
Sure, Stephanie.
Great. Thanks so much, John. Great to see this iteration after seeing it at New Faces, I guess, a couple years ago now. So I'll focus my questions maybe a little bit around your dependent variable. So you kind of focus on these, you know, specific legal policies by China around these three categories. And at times you're also talking a little bit about the actual, I guess, measurement of you know, either wind turbine installation. So I'm curious to what extent you're focusing on like the number of legal policies by China versus the downstream effects of those policies in terms of actual number of JVs. I guess the actual like amount of know-how in people's heads is like really difficult to measure, or the actual number of wind turbines installed. So I'm curious, like, are you looking at some of those downstream consequences in other parts of the project? Just because, as we all know, you know, the state may pass some laws, but maybe they won't actually be followed. And kind of one second question around that dependent variable. I'm curious, are there any costs to China as a government of just putting these things on paper? Is there a cost in just in terms of like the bureaucratic capacity to put these things on paper, or like a reputation for doing business with the world? Because I guess I totally agree, you know, it makes sense to prioritize the strategic industries, but where your other two independent variables are also in play in terms of having a good enforcement capacity and being downstream, like why not just, you know, you use your use that leverage in the non-strategic sectors too? And I'm sort of thinking, you know, beyond the three categories of strategic interest, you could imagine either baby formula or luxury goods, like areas where, yeah, I mean, that's one that might be a strategic interest actually, but, you know, regime security. Yeah, exactly. I guess, you know, just areas, you know, why not do it in the areas, you know, even if it's not necessarily strategic. So just curious a little about the costs. Thanks.
Cool. Yeah, no. So in this paper, I'm not really trying to systematically measure other sort of downstream implications of the use of these policy tools. Some of that is just data scarcity. And you know, some of what I try to do to get around that is basically provide, in the case of these, qualitative evidence that this actually led to real, you know, this led to real changes in the behavior of foreign firms in China. And the outcome of that was substantially increased activity in various ways. And then also just trying to lean on, I mean, there is a pretty big body of literature in economics that basically tries to get at precisely this question of like, under what conditions and to what extent do things like quid pro quo, technology transfer policies, joint venture requirements lead to actual technological spillovers. And you know, sort of, it's an interesting literature, because basically the first wave of literature came out in the early 2000s, and it was about the 1990s when these policies were not very effective. So it came to the conclusion that actually these policies don't really work. And then in the last 5 years, there's been a new wave of econometric literature using much more sophisticated tools that basically covers the post-WTO period and shows actually these policies massively worked and were hugely successful in many cases, I mean, not uniformly. So at least for this paper itself, I'm just trying to lean on that to make the case that we should care about these policies because other people have shown they really matter. And in my cases, I'm going to show they really have these like downturn effects. And that actually gets to the second point, which is I do think that imposing these policies is costly for China. I think it's costly. And I mean, one piece of evidence for that is just that, as Tom was kind of alluding to, I mean, what I see, if you look at like the national trade estimate reports that the US Trade Representative publishes, so there's like an annual report that they publish where they list all of the countries that are doing bad things on trade and then kind of provide a summary of that. And immediately after 2006, when China launches the medium long-term program, and a little bit before that, but really after 2006, we start to see discussions of forced technology transfer show up in these policies. So there is a reputational cost. And we do see in the strategic, as I guess it begins the strategic economic dialogue, then the strategic and economic dialogue, this becomes one of the main things that the Bush and Obama administration are raising with senior Chinese officials all the time. And I think that there is, and what we see in wind turbine technology is that basically once China kind of gets the technology and gets going off the ground, once Chinese firms are competitive, China removes the policies really quickly because they realize if they want to go abroad, then they're going to be facing a risk of negative reciprocity by trade partners that are angry over the fact that their firms don't have unrestricted access in China. So I think there is a sense of not a reputational cost to these. And then generally, I think that there, you know, it is meaningfully different to implement a policy that means that all foreign firms in a given industry must form a joint venture. I mean, that is a very costly move for a foreign firm, not least because it implies technology licensing and potential technology transfer, but also because it's literally just costly to open up an equity joint venture with a Chinese company. I mean, that's an expensive thing to do. So just to say that, yeah, I mean, I think that there is a reason that China has to be somewhat judicious about when it uses these. I mean, of course, the flip side of that is also just that there's less of an incentive to use the policies in the first place in industries where you don't expect that, where there is not particularly high bang for your buck in terms of like national economic competitiveness, or where opportunities for technology transfer to begin with are relatively limited. So, I mean, there is a sort of like a selection bias or selection effect there to some extent as well. Yes, Sabina.
Yeah, thank you. There were really a lot of interesting thoughts or thought-provoking ideas. I was wondering, or I found your conceptualization of strategic industries really interesting. And I was wondering whether you had some sort of comparison between your conceptualization and the Chinese government ones, like how they would conceptualize these sectors. And just to assess how much of a gap there is, because one thing I was wondering is how regime security comes in your conceptualization, because I understood that this was really important, but wouldn't it be the Chinese government who decides it'd be more important what the Chinese government thinks a strategic industry is. That was my main question.
Let me just show. I mean, so one thing I did do at the sort of robustness test was basically take three sort of authoritative central government policy documents, the MLP, the Strategic Emerging Industries Initiative, and Made in China 2025, and constructed an alternative measure of strategic industries using these, and then rerun everything with that. And, you know, basically there are way fewer observations because those lists generate fewer strategic industries than the kind of objective measure I'm trying to develop. But we see basically the relationship is moving in the same direction. And I have other things in the paper that show that there's a fair degree of overlap. I mean, it's not perfect. And part of this is just, I mean, it's kind of one of these things where the way when I made the decision, okay, I'm going to try to find this objective measure. And then the next task was, okay, well, how do I do that? And then it's like, well, let me go around and look at the literature and see if anyone's tried to come up with a way of conceptualizing and measuring these. And it just so happens that pretty much the best paper to do that is this paper in security studies from 2022, which has this really nice discussion of sort of logics of strategic assets. And then basically what I did then was say, okay, I'm going to try to come up with measures that are at where, you know, the fidelity to these logics is as high as possible. Even if that generates a list of strategic industries that in some ways is bad for my argument. Because, for example, one of the things to measure R&D intensive industries or to measure the cumulative learning effects, I use this kind of list of R&D intensive industries that this consultancy developed. And you know, basically what we see from that, what that list does is it just lists the 1,000 most R&D intensive companies in the world. Mm-hmm. And then it lists corresponding industry codes. And so I use that to kind of back out an idea, okay, well, these are the industries, if these are where the R&D intensive companies are, these are R&D intensive industries, they match this definition. But you know, one of the industries one of the 1,000 most R&D intensive industries is tobacco production, which I wouldn't necessarily think of strategic, but actually weirdly enough in the Chinese context, it's kind of strategic because it's a really important source of central government revenue, but it's bad for my argument because it moves in the opposite direction. China doesn't use
it. Why is it so capital intensive, R&D intensive?
I haven't looked into that closely, but tobacco processing, I think it's actually a fairly, like in a weird way, there's like some, I mean, it's in the 1,000 top companies and some of that may be.
Yeah, no, I just think about R&D.
I know.
I think they've got it down.
Yeah. They're still doing it, but
I mean, semiconductors would be high on.
Oh, definitely, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's
So on the regime security thing, you know, I guess I should admit I haven't thought a lot about like, or I haven't tried to delineate like, okay, here's the national power considerations, here are the regime security considerations, and here are the different logics they follow to get me to a list of strategic industries. Basically, what I'm trying to do here is kind of use a admittedly like somewhat simplified thing of saying that it's not just national power, like it's a bundle of security interests that lead to thinking about strategic, but I'm not wedded to the idea of regime security being in there. And I don't want to put like too much stake on that. Really, that's just to say, like, I think in the Chinese context, when you're trying to think about how the government thinks about its security, regime security kind of falls in there. But that's at more of like a conceptual level and doesn't translate directly into the operationalization of measurement.
Hey John, thank you for the talk. It's super interesting. I think I have perhaps one question for now. So I'm curious about more on the roles of firm and the governments at the local level and at the negotiation desk. So I'm curious, the role of this policy are something like when they're on the negotiation desk, it's like, oh, these are the documents there. We should follow one by one. We need to abide them. Or is there something like there are more negotiation room between the firms and the local governments? In the case that if the firms don't go to Shandong, for example, they can move to Shanghai, something like that. So where
competition.
Yeah. So I'm curious about the role of the central government's policies in the actual negotiation table. Yeah.
No, that's a great question. So the part of the reason I focus on these policies is because these are all central level policies in the case of the NDRC. I mean, so basically the NDRC is actually making, I mean, it's sort of like, I think the negotiation, so I don't look explicitly at the local government level, except in my cases, I kind of get into that. But basically, I think what's happening at the local government levels is more, once the decision to form a joint venture has been made, I think there's a tremendous amount of negotiation over the terms of the joint venture, about what exactly is implied within the joint venture. And I think that that's where local governments play a really important role, but local governments are not in a position to say that a firm doesn't need to form a joint venture. Like that requirement is mandated from the center. So a joint venture will have to be formed. And the question is, what's going to be the exact content of that joint venture? There's some negotiating room for the local governments at that level, but not at the level of like the imposition of these policies. And for investments over $100 million, I mean, these are, you know, it's like it's at least written into the law that regional development and reform commissions, or the regional versions of the NDRC, they don't have the authority to approve those. Over $100 million, it has to be the central authority in Beijing that makes the final approval decision.
That's the cutoff, $100 million?
$100 million, yeah, exactly. So below that, it's the regional development reform commissions that have that authority to make the decision. So I think there's based on these things, right? Local governments are definitely hugely important to the broader question of how technology transfer happens in China. But at least I think when it comes to the point of negotiating over, you know, basically whether a firm is going to make a decision and whether central authorities are going to impose a mandate in this industry, that negotiation happens through the central levels. That's at least what my interviews and my sense of the literature suggests.
So negotiations are between the firm and the central government?
In a lot of cases, they are. Yeah. I mean, like the really big ones. No, but even the negotiations, like, I mean, what's amazing is like, so one of my cases is on aircraft manufacturing. And in a lot of the really big, you know, so there are like, there's a really famous instance where, I mean, basically it was the NDRC at the central level jointly with Airbus announced a deal, you know, I mean, and that happens pretty frequently where it's actually, so the terms of these deals, especially when they are things that would go into sort of like national level, especially economic zones and things like that, the terms of those deals are being negotiated directly by the NDRC, not my understanding, the local governments. But I think local governments fit in the story because I think, you know, part of the reason, and I would say actually semiconductors is an interesting example where part of what's going on in the semiconductor story, and actually Yellen Tan's book kind of gets into this, is that it's local governments that really feel this employment maximization imperative.
Yeah.
And so it's local governments that in a way become the main advocates of MNEs.
Yeah.
Like MNEs are negotiating, I mean, especially the big foreign companies, they're negotiating directly with central authorities and Department of Commerce. NDRC, if they can get an audience in the NDRC, although that's very difficult for foreign firms.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're not able to go through central governments, they do use local governments to try to push back on central government.
But Yaling's story is very different from yours because she's studying something different, right?
But
she's much more interested in the competition between the localities, right?
Yeah.
And the role of.
So, I mean, that all, just to say
for
that
your
this
world,
is,
it doesn't apply.
No, not exactly. I mean, it's for this particular policy outcome, it doesn't apply. I mean, it's sort of like if I, you know, I've thought about for the book project, like, can I do the whole local government side of the story? And I just, that would be like a 700 page book. Like, that's kind of where I'm just like, I'm gonna use this book to look at the central level and say, localities matter, read Yelling's book, you know, kind of thing. But basically, I think a lot of the negotiation does happen by the central government. And then also there's this other dynamic of, like in semiconductors, part of the story was, as I was saying, just that it was, chip makers were leaning on like the Shanghai or the Wuxi government, which depended massively on these chip makers to drive employment and export growth as their advocates against introducing technology transfer policies.
Because it would alienate the people.
Yeah. Because the foreign firms would have just
moved out.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mayumi.
Yes. Yeah. Hi. Thank you so much. My question is sort of the choice of Chinese government to choose JD route versus other methods of bringing China into higher value chain. So espionage, IP theft, or hiring foreign scientists, or growing all these talents, right, own talents. So JD, this transfer of technology is just one way among many strategies that they can take. So I wonder if you see more sort of interaction effect in areas where JD route doesn't work. And then maybe because other strategies are available, tactics available, then they don't really have to rely on JD. Can you talk to that kind of interaction effect? And I'm just still thinking about why companies like High Speed Rail wouldn't consider the cost of a technology transfer. Because it seems, I mean, does it matter whether there are rival companies on the table? And then it's more about competition among these rival companies about how willing you are to give technology to Chinese companies. So whether there are rival companies among foreign companies, that changes the leveraging power of China.
Yeah, that'd be great. So on the first question, you know, I mean, definitely it's the case that that China's using a whole suite of policy tools, and that these are not the only ones, you know. And I should just emphasize, I mean, a big part of the reason I look at these policy tools, well, one, because these policy tools are a big part of the story of foreign governments getting angry about Chinese practices. So they matter for thinking about things like US-China relations. And two, they're the only part of the story that we can really measure on a systematic basis. So then I'm going to try in other parts of the project to look at the other things. We just can't measure those because we don't know when exactly. We don't have a systematic sense of those. What I would say, though, is I don't see these things as like real substitutes. And I definitely don't think in the case of industries I've looked at closely, like semiconductors, that the Chinese authorities just concluded that they didn't need to encourage foreign firms to partner with Chinese companies because they could get everything they wanted through espionage. I think it's clearly the case that they couldn't and didn't get what they wanted through espionage. I think that there was a lot of stuff that they were trying to do, but pursuing these things through informal measures or informal pressures or, you know, whatever inducements to share technology, I think there are real limits to the efficacy of that strategy, especially when it comes to really powerful foreign companies like Intel. I mean, these companies were just like, screw you. I mean, I see a lot of these other more informal tools as kind of like second best measures. You know, if you're not able to do, for whatever reason, like the formal things aren't working, then you look to compensate in various ways. But I don't think it's the case that China concluded for some reason that in these industries, these other things are working so well, so we're just not going
to. I'll just say one thing about that, which is in certain technologies, if you were just to steal the blueprints for a technology, by the time you reverse engineered it in certain fields, it would be old. It would be old technology. So it's much better to have the company there showing you how it's actually done from soup to nuts, and helping you build the whole capacity than it is just to have the stolen blueprints.
And just remind me of your second question again.
Second question is about other factors that affect living power of China, for example, availability of the right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And rivalry among them.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. So definitely, I mean, there like probably like a scope condition of the theory would be that it kind of breaks down if we imagine a scenario like, for example, now advanced lithography machinery, where there's a single company that has a perfect monopoly on a particular product. Like that's a case where, you know, even if China is a big downstream market, it's not going to be able to wield the same kind of course of leverage over those companies. So a lot of this, and I don't really kind of explicitly model what's happening on the foreign firm side, but definitely implicit in this is that, you know, we're talking about industries where there are at least a few firms, which is basically the case for almost all. I mean, even like within semiconductors, there are a million different parts of the semiconductor supply chain, and probably, you know, 60% of them have between 3 and 7 firms. That's really all you need for a prisoner's dilemma dynamic to develop, where foreign firms are, you know, basically their incentives to defect from cooperation here being, hey, let's partner to like limit technology transfer to China. You know, once you get more than about 3 firms, the incentives to defect become really strong, especially if you have one company that is, you know, has a much lower market share and sees partnering with China as a way to gain asymmetric market share, right, and leverage. And actually, what's interesting is in semiconductors, I mean, we do see like Intel, for example, you know, all this is happening outside these formal joint venture requirements, but there are cases where, you know, Intel in things for like logic processors where Intel was dominant in CPU design and fabrication. Intel, you know, it did some assembly in China, but it was very, very, obviously very guarded of its technology because this is its core proprietary technology. Intel also had a big presence in the NAND market. That's a form of memory semiconductor. But it was like the 7th big player in NAND, and it had about a 10% market share. And the big players were Micron, Samsung, and SK Hynix. And basically, Intel came to the conclusion that they were dead in the NAND market anyway. So let's just partner with Chinese companies and give them a bunch of technology. And maybe this will be like a Hail Mary pass and we'll get, you know, big market share. And you see that dynamic repeated over and over. I mean, McDonnell Douglas did this with China in the 1990s and so on and so forth. So anyway, yeah, but there is an implicit, like, I'm assuming enough firms that a prisoner's dilemma sets in and firms have incentives to, you know, like give in essentially. You had your
answers. Yeah, I'm wondering if we can speak a bit about discretionary season, thank you, tech extraction amongst similar industries, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I was under the impression that China's civil aviation industry has really struggled to indigenize compared, in particular, not for want of trying, but compared to its military aviation industry. And I was wondering whether you could illuminate why that hasn't happened, because I'm no aerospace engineer, but I can't believe the differences are too great. Is it something to do with, is strategic the critical element in that difference? And then that speaks to then the discussion earlier about the definition of strategic, because civil aviation is not military, but in my mind, it is fairly strategic. It's very significant for moving people around China. And I believe it's been written by, I think, Richard Eberleifer in Foreign Affairs, that it could, that particular choke point could be leveraged by the United States. So,
So definitely on your first point, or actually I'll start with that. I'll take them in reverse. So civil aviation is absolute. I mean, that's like top of my list on strategic industries because of the dual use implications, because of, you know, it's a very important industry for a variety of reasons. And that was the industry that in the figure I showed had the most, China used more joint venture requirements in aircraft manufacturing, civil aircraft manufacturing, than in any other industry in the post-WTO period. So they definitely saw this as a strategic. They needed technology transfers to develop the industry, and they pursued them through these formal means. So it's like, it perfectly fits my story in that respect. Of course, then there's a question of why did they appear to be relatively unsuccessful in aircraft manufacturing? So I'll say two things on that. The first is that actually after I think after semiconductor design and fabrication, building a large commercial aircraft is probably the single most important, most difficult things humans have ever done. I mean, it's an extraordinarily complex process. Like this is, it's like almost right up there with the most advanced semiconductors because not only because there are particular parts that are extremely technologically intensive, in particular the engine and the avionics systems, but also in a similar way with advanced semiconductors, there's just everything that goes into the system integration, which is incredibly complicated. And this is why, you know, very basically two firms can do it in the world. I mean, because it's a really, really hard thing to do. So I think one reason that it took China, it's taken China a relatively long time to catch up in aircraft design manufacturing is just that it's really, really hard to go from zero to 90 in this industry. And there are massive barriers to entry, massive barriers to progress. I will say, actually, and this is, I have a case study on aircraft manufacturing, and you know, one of the things we, one of my takeaways, at least from the research I've done, is that I think, while it's by no means like a smashing success, I think that the kind of mainstream Western narrative around this as a failure is also not entirely accurate, because China has made a lot of progress in a lot of parts of the aircraft manufacturing supply chain. And they've done, and actually, I mean, now the C-99 is not a great plane, but it's flying. And it will, you know, it's there, it's getting commercial orders and they're learning a tremendous amount through the process. And I mean, it depends on what happens to Boeing, because Boeing has kind of shot itself in the foot. But I mean, I think it's not inconceivable that the C-99 will actually be certainly widely used in China and potentially outside of China in the future. But of course, there are still real choke points for making aircraft engines, which China hasn't mastered yet. I mean, they're trying really hard, but they haven't mastered. But to say that it's not like China is still at point zero with aircraft. I mean, they've come a long way from where they were 25 years ago.
There's a third reason, which is that this supplying countries of the aircraft technology don't allow their companies, even if they're in a JV with a Chinese company, to transfer some of the technology. So long before the semiconductor restrictions, we had restrictions on the transfer of anything related to the making of a turbofan jet engine. And that was for military reasons, but maybe also for economic. So you can have the whole JV thing. So yeah, it would still fit John's thesis, because you'd have all the regulations and demands. And then the U.S. or European company would run into a brick wall when the Chinese said, and here's some more other technology we want.
No. I know you have to go, but I'm curious your thoughts on this, because one thing that from talking with people in the industry, you know, my impression from my conversations with people was that in practice, what happened over the course of the 1990s and early 2000s, this is kind of like in the heyday of excitement about globalization and China's integration into the WTO and whatnot, was that aircraft companies, I mean, Boeing in particular, had invested hugely in watering down implementation of some of these export controls. Obviously, there were tight controls on some things.
What do you mean? What does it mean to invest in
watering?
Oh, yeah, they lobbied hard.
Yeah.
They didn't lobby really hard. They didn't just lobby in Congress. They lobbied with me.
Oh, yeah. And so what's interesting is that, for example,
it didn't work, though, I could say.
Well, yeah. I mean, so I think for some things it didn't. Although what's interesting is, like, when China announced C919, at first, CFM International, which makes the jet engine that's in C919, they're the main engine maker for the narrow body aircraft.
Yeah.
They basically did say that they would open up a final assembly line, which is not the same, you know, obviously it doesn't imply transferring technology.
What year was that?
2009.
Yeah.
Didn't end up doing that because, they didn't end up doing that because then the Civil Aviation Administration said, okay, well, as part of the inspection process for the engine, we want like all the specs on the engine. And basically CFM International, which did have a monopoly, so that gets to this point of like, they're a virtual monopoly for this class of engine. They said, screw you. But then interestingly enough, in avionics, which is probably the second most sort of technology intensive and probably the most sensitive part of the thing, GE, basically they were a lead player in that market. And they formed a joint venture with a subsidiary of the main Chinese aviation company, and pretty much gave exactly the same technology that is in the 787 Dreamliner
Which technology?
The avionics, the avionics, integrated modular avionics system. And basically what they did is they took out two little things that were specifically controlled by U.S. export controls, two little things, sent a bunch of engineers over, and then trained the Chinese people on how to fill them up. So, I mean, these companies, like, they have a, you know, like a fiduciary responsibility to their investors, I guess. So they do everything they can to maximize their profits.
Yes.
That means giving technology to China, they'll find ways to get around. This is exactly what I think we're seeing these companies doing.